Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Welcome to Ruination, the early years. I'm King, and joining me today, as always, is my expert guide through the chaotic archives of Big Fatty Online lore.
Hello, and hello to you. We are continuing our chronological excavation of BFO's foundational years, and today we are tackling a really, really critical period.
We are. We're looking at the week spanning Monday, May 5th, 2008, all the way through Friday, May 9th. So that's episodes 67 through 71.
Mm-hmm. And this five-day stretch is, well, it's pretty astonishing. Our mission today is to summarize the life and the stories of Big Fatty Online during this time. And we're really focusing on this core paradox that just defines his content.
Exactly. This is the week where BFO just demonstrates his absolute mastery of balancing. I mean, just complete personal chaos.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking openly drunk broadcasting. We have explicit boundary-pushing jokes, and he's addressing old network feuds.
Right. And at the same time, he's balancing all that with these immovable, profoundly personal anchors and rituals. It's really something.
It is. He's talking about this solemn annual visit to a friend's grave, and then he's giving out this super logistical, almost domestic advice for Mother's Day.
And planning months of travel. It's all in the same breath as, you know, a drunken sing-along.
Yeah. It's this framework of a really rigorously structured life that basically provides the permission slip for all the content's ruinous nature.
That's a perfect way to put it. And if we really want to understand that contradiction, we have to start exactly where BFO starts, with this bizarre anecdote that opened the week.
Mm-hmm.
It's a perfect microcosm of how BFO can instantly metabolize the absurdity of the digital world right into his ongoing network story.
We are talking, of course, about the Amazon story. This is just a classic tale of consumer targeting gone horribly wrong.
So what happened?
BFO recounts searching on Amazon for, of all things, whole dead rabbits.
Whole dead rabbits.
Yes. Not just, you know, cuts of meat, but the whole animal. You have to assume it's for some kind of specific, probably gourmet cooking project.
Okay. And the algorithm did not take that well.
Not at all. The resulting targeted recommendations were instantaneous and just completely unhinged. This is where the algorithm failed to connect gourmet cooking with his profile and just took a hard left turn.
Into what?
Explicit adult material. He described the suggestions list, you know, the items you also might be interested in section, as including leather and cock rings and all this stuff.
Wow. From dead rabbits to cock rings. That's a leap.
It's just pure comedy. It shows you the limitation of those early algorithms. And BFO perfectly captures that moment where your private browsing history just explodes into this public digital embarrassment.
And the key thing here, it wasn't just a fleeting joke for him. This was an ongoing problem.
Right. He said every time he logged into Amazon, the site would just relentlessly push this stuff, and he'd find himself yelling at his monitor, "Stop with the sex toys!"
He turned a technical glitch into recurring content currency.
And the context he layered on top of it makes it quintessential BFO lore. Because he pointed out he had just managed to achieve a kind of domestic tranquility on the site.
With the baby book.
Exactly. For months, Amazon had been relentlessly recommending baby books to him, which was this running joke that tied into the network's long-standing sarcastic narrative about fatherhood.
And the second he gets that fixed, the algorithm doesn't just stop. It pivots.
It immediately shifted the recommendations to his friend and his former co-host, Larry H. Vader.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah. BFO just gleefully reported that Larry H. Vader was now the one getting the perpetual baby book ads. He mockingly asked him if he was expecting, because apparently, dear old dad was now getting the whole baby book recommendations going again.
It's a magnificent chain reaction. BFO proves that even personalized advertising is a mess, and any corporate failure can be weaponized for humor, especially if it embarrasses Larry H. Vader.
It just perfectly sets the stage for a week that's going to oscillate violently between the serious and the completely absurd.
So from that digital absurdity, BFO immediately grounds the start of the week in something really profound.
Mm-hmm. Episode 67, on Monday, May 5th, he opens up celebrating Cinco de Mayo, which he, of course, pronounces Cinco de Mayo, before he sets the theme of the week.
Which is his Harrow weekend and a little tale of death.
That tale of death is the annual trek he takes to visit the grave of his friend George.
It's an intimate annual ritual, and the contrast between this solemn task and, you know, the rest of his content is just,
yeah,
it's so striking.
And he doesn't just mention it. He discusses the location, the emotion of the visit with this surprising depth. He clearly views this ritual as a necessary anchor.
He talks about the burial plot itself.
With immense pride. He notes that it's very nice and that it overlooks the river and the Cooper River bridges. The quality of the view, even in death, is this point of personal connection for him. It's a piece of structure for BFO.
And the moment he shared about the visit is maybe the most vulnerable moment of the entire week.
I agree. He confessed that he almost laid down on George's plot, not out of some morbid grief, but because the view was just so good.
Yeah, George would be happy with it.
Exactly. He literally thought if George could just sit up and look, he would be very happy with his chosen resting spot. So the impulse was just one of shared comfort and appreciation.
But he didn't do it.
No, he pulled himself back. He confirmed that he restrained himself.
And that self-regulation is the key. The impulse, that desire for extreme comfort, maybe even to share the space, that's the chaos.
But the act of refraining.
That's the structure.
Yes. He takes this genuine, profane vulnerability, shares it with thousands of people, and then immediately pivots to something completely different.
The Random Act of Kindness campaign.
Right. He asks everyone to perform a RAK on Monday, May 5th. And he's enthusiastic about it, but in this very analytical, structured way. He was genuinely amazed that an actual Random Act of Kindness foundation existed.
He treats it like vital network trivia. He gives the community the official lore.
Mm-hmm. He noted that National RAK Week was officially in February the 11th through the 17th, and that World Kindness Day is November 13th. He's urging listeners to mark these dates. He's approaching goodwill with the precision of a historian.
And the foundation suggests, you know, simple things. Open a door, say hello, pick up letter.
But when BFO's community gets involved, the submissions become instantly BFO flavored. He noted on May 6th that only people as fed up as I am could come up with these acts.
And that's the core appeal, taking a pure concept and applying BFO's unique, cynical, but sometimes genuinely generous worldview to it.
Let's get into the submissions because they really illustrate the community's warped interpretation of charity.
Okay, so we had Archer, who performed a simple RAK. He offered to let someone have his parking space.
Right. That's baseline compliance. Very straightforward.
Then we have Larry Cly.
Of course. BFO's resident limit tester, his RAK was buying BFO a cupcake.
Which is a thoughtful, specific gift.
It is. However, Larry Cly explicitly refused to let the fat C in line behind him go first, illustrating his personal philosophy that there's just got to be a limit to random acts of kindness.
The kindness is targeted. It's not universal.
Exactly. It raises that fascinating question. Is an act truly random if it's pre-selected to only benefit people you approve of? For Larry Cly, the limit of kindness is the moment it inconveniences him or rewards someone he sees as an opponent.
That says a lot about the network's internal dynamics.
Mm-hmm. And then Michael and Stoutgart raised this fantastic meta question. He asked if listening to the show itself counted as a random act of kindness.
And BFO's answer on this is so precise.
How? Like a constitutional lawyer. He says, no, it is not random at all. It is a deliberate act of kindness.
Which implies that the effort required to engage with the show, to listen to the chaos, is a conscious expenditure of your energy. And BFO respects that intentionality.
The most BFO-adjacent act, though, had to come from John and Ailey.
Oh, this one was a classic.
He spent $50 filling up his gas tank, and he knew that money would eventually filter up the economic chain. So his cynical interpretation was...
He's helping pay for a portion of an oil executive wife's tit lift.
Yes. That is the perfect blend of extreme generosity and profound social critique that the audience just eats up. It's not just giving. It's giving with an attached thesis statement about wealth distribution.
And BFO loved it. He told John, I love you so much you have no idea.
So this establishes the week's dual mandate, right? Personal commitment and cynical charity. And speaking of mandates, BFO quickly shifts to the required domestic structure of the coming weekend.
Mother's Day, Sunday, May 11th.
And this is where BFO becomes the voice of adult responsibility. He lays down a serious, non-negotiable rule for the audience.
You don't think mess up Mother's Day. It's presented as this existential failure that you have to avoid at all costs.
And he doesn't just issue the command.
Yeah.
He provides highly logistical, pragmatic advice. He tells you to order flowers online now on Friday and have them delivered early.
He even details the dual benefit. Your mother gets to enjoy them for a couple of days before the actual day.
And you, the consumer, you get cheaper shipping.
It's sentimental duty, perfectly blended with pure thriftiness and advanced logistical planning. It's the absolute opposite of chaos.
It's the required structure to balance out the drunken memory lane segments we're going to get to later.
And finally, he uses this RAK push to encourage participation in the ultimate piece of network structure.
The listener map.
He asks Rebecca, who he describes with classic BFO specificity as looking like a big old turtle.
Oh, dear.
And all other listeners to put themselves on the listener map. He reminds everyone that he's updated the Ruining Your City page. He's turning geographical data collection into a signature joke about local disruption.
The map is BFO's way of quantifying and controlling his chaos. He needs to know exactly where the destruction is originating from.
That need for structure brings us right into section two. Ruination Logistics. This week covered BFO's travel schedule, local gossip, and a really critical piece of historical network drama.
The Little Fatty Cast, or LFC, breakup.
We start with the local rumor mill, which BFO always uses as content filler. He got the hot gossip regarding Patrick's Pub Online, a known spot in the Charleston area.
And the drama was entirely bureaucratic. The pub failed to renew its special South Carolina Sunday liquor license in time.
A seemingly small administrative failure.
With massive, immediate social consequences.
Right. The consequence was catastrophic for the local gay scene, especially for the weekend rhythm. The pub had to close at 11:30 p.m. on Saturday night.
And it was closed all day Sunday.
Meaning they completely missed the big established tea dance.
Yeah. And BFO reported that this immediate closure led to this flurry of local speculation that they had just boarded up the doors entirely. It just shows how fast a procedural error can spiral into massive local rumor and network drama.
Which BFO then broadcasts to a national audience.
Mm-hmm. He turns that local crisis right into a historical reckoning. Larry H. Vader, his former co-host on the Little Fatty Cast.
Which ran from, what, October 2005 until 2007?
That's right. He directly asked BFO on air why he quit the LFC.
And this leads to BFO's classic two-part answer. You get the joke answer, and then you get the highly revealing public answer.
It's a perfect study in his communication style. The honest joke answer, delivered with that classic self-deprecating flair,
was that he was getting too fat and I couldn't fit through the door of the studio.
Exactly. It's self-deprecating humor used to diffuse the seriousness of the underlying conflict.
But then you get the public substantive answer. And that reveals a major truth about the pressures of early network podcasting.
He said he lost interest. And why? Because he just got tired of the bickering and the misinformation from what he estimated was 90% of the community.
I want to focus on that phrase, the bickering and the misinformation. Because BFO thrives on generating and participating in chaos and gossip on his own show.
Right.
So what was it about the LFC type of bickering that he found so fundamentally unsustainable?
I think it comes down to control and narrative integrity. BFO generates chaos, but he maintains control over the facts presented on his show. The LFC was co-hosted, so it was a shared narrative space.
Oh, okay.
And the community feedback on LFC, according to BFO, was full of people deliberately getting details wrong or just constantly arguing he wasn't the sole architect of the storyline anymore.
So the chaos he creates is structured, but the chaos they generated was unstructured and corrosive to him.
Yes. He summarized his exit with a declaration that really highlights the transactional nature of his content. I am too busy for you to be this fat. It's a statement of prioritization. The drama just wasn't worth the effort and the emotional toll anymore.
That frustration gives you a clear insight into the pressure of daily podcasting when you are the public face of the material.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of being busy, BFO immediately details his intense summer travel schedule. He declares he will be a busy lesbian this summer.
And it's a tightly structured timeline. The week of May 5th through the 11th is dedicated to hosting The Nip, his longtime friend and fellow Leather Club member.
He even teases that The Nip might appear on the show, once again blending his private social life with his public content creation.
Then we leap forward to the highly anticipated Orlando Gay Days trip. That's scheduled for June 4th through the 9th, where he'll be traveling with Larry Cly.
And the destination details he provides are so crucial for his audience.
They're staying at the All-Star Movies Resort. For anyone who doesn't know, that's one of Disney's original budget-friendly value resorts.
And that level of detail is a signal to his core audience about accessibility and shared cultural history. Staying at an all-star resort confirms this event is approachable. It's not some high roller exclusive thing.
It's very much on brand.
And this trip is highly structured. He confirms a special announcement regarding an event. a tea party is pending. Structure enabling the party.
Right after Orlando, he's off to the San Francisco Bay Area in mid-June. He's going to see the Buff, his former roommate. This trip is detailed down to the hour.
He confirms plans include a pot roast Friday, which establishes a domestic anchor right in the middle of a big city visit. And for Saturday night, he's staying at the Beck's Motor Lodge.
Near Market and Church Street. And the reason for that specific lodging choice is pure pragmatic party logistics.
Mm-hmm. He notes that from Beck's, he can stumble home from the Edge, which is a famous local gay bar. That one detail tells you everything about the planned evening.
The purpose is immersion, intoxication, and a manageable, if slightly tipsy, walk back to his room.
That precision in logistics, naming specific, historic, and often budget-friendly venues, it's a key signal to his audience. He's organizing a reliable, repeatable structure for his personal chaos.
And he confirms he'll be back in San Francisco in July, from the 4th through the 10th. The whole summer is set.
Before moving on, though, he checks the listener map one last time.
And he spots Straight Bob in Melbourne, Australia, who is posting a picture.
And his immediate response just, once again, pushes the boundaries of intimacy and humor. He turns a simple digital connection into a transactional challenge. His instant joke to Straight Bob was, "How quickly can you send me a picture with your pants off?"
It's an example of how BFO treats listener engagement. It has to be high commitment, high stakes, and a little bit boundary crossing to be acknowledged. A simple picture isn't enough.
He demands content currency.
So as BFO moves from the geopolitical logistics of his summer travel back to the moment-to-moment show, we enter section 3, pop culture and memory lane music.
Mm-hmm. BFO frequently apologizes for missing this segment because of his own discursive tendencies, which he calls nattering on. This week, however, he commits to delivering the trivia.
And it reveals a lot about his hidden preference for structure.
It really does. He consistently shows that, despite the surface-level nostalgia, have this powerful underlying theme of rigid structure or enforced isolation.
Let's start with May 6th, the paper chase. He played the theme from the second year of the TV series.
He provided the core trivia. It's based on a 1970 novel and a 1973 film, and it chronicles James Hart at Harvard Law School, who is obsessed with the severe Professor Charles Kingsfield.
And the key insight BFO shares is that famous quote that just encapsulates the entire brutal ethos of high-stakes academia.
You come in here with a skull full of mush, and if you survive, you leave thinking like a lawyer.
He loves that concept. It's about a difficult, defined process that transforms chaos, the mush, into structure. Thinking like a lawyer.
It's a perfect mirror for his own creative process. He's turning the mush of his daily life into structured, repeatable content.
Then on May 8th, we got Northern Exposure.
Right. He played the theme after referencing a moose, which is a perfectly BFO-esque transition.
He kind of struggled with the genre definition, didn't he? He was asking if it was a dramedy or a Camara.
He did, but he nailed the core facts. Emmy-winning show about Dr. Joel Flamin, an urban doctor transplanted to the quirky, isolated town of Sicily, Alaska, ran from 1990 to 1995, 110 episodes. He just described it as a quirky, 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 quirky show.
And again, the theme is enforced structure and isolation. The protagonist is stuck in a strange, defined place, forced to interact with a set cast of characters.
It's a mirror for the small, highly focused world BFO creates for himself and for you, the listener.
Now, the final memory lane selection on May 9th is famous for the context. This is the Red Wand Show.
It is. BFO opened the episode by immediately admitting his state of mind. He confessed he'd had a little beverage and was drunk on red wine. He labeled the entire broadcast a train wreck.
A classic BFO move, anticipating and preempting criticism, but just embracing the disaster. He literally joked that the show that night was hosted by red wine.
But even with the intoxication, he delivered the goods. He played the sing-along theme from Mr. Ed.
And the trivia is vintage BFO detail. It shows his sharp memory, even when he's impaired.
He noted the show ran from 61 to 66 and was historically significant as the first series ever to debut as a mid-season replacement.
The premise, of course, a talking horse.
Yeah.
Mr. Ed, who only spoke to his owner, Wilbur Post.
And BFO highlighted the specific rationale for Alan Young's casting. He was chosen because he seemed like a guy a horse would talk to.
It's a very BFO definition of chemistry. The perfect, highly specific compatibility between two very unusual characters.
He wove in other nostalgic content as well. Listener Candy sent an MP3 of the Speedy Alka-Seltzer commercial.
Which BFO noted sounded like it was played on a Victrola.
Right. And he had the trivia ready. Speedy was created in 1951, voiced by Dick Beale, appeared in over 200 ads from 54 to 65.
And a quick update on television's present day. For the time, DFO reported seeing a commercial for the Million Dollar Password revival, which was set to premiere in June, hosted by Regis Philbin.
And the confirmed celebrities for that first episode were the perfect blend of nostalgia and contemporary relevance. Doogie Howser and Miss Betty White. He's always connecting the icons of the past to the present day.
But let's get back to the source of the train wreck. BFO revealed the cause of his condition. It was a going-away party he attended at his work, the coal mine.
And the menu is important.
Yes. The food consumed, shrimp, which he sarcastically called scrimps, a term he immediately linked to the character Omar.
And artichoke dip. And critically, the consumption of red wine, which led directly to the drunk Mr. Ed episode.
So the chaos is never random. It's always structurally linked to a specific work-related event and a specific consumption log.
His life is compartmentalized, even when those compartments bleed into one another via red wine.
This organizational discipline, even in his chaos, it leads us right to section four, the long tease, gay days, tea announcement, and the listener response. This all dominated episode 71.
The official announcement delivered on May 8th was meticulously structured, the exact opposite of a train wreck. The event is a special afternoon tea on Gay Day Saturday, June 7th at 3 p.m.
The venue is the Grand Fiend Hotel. This is not just some casual meetup. BFO treats this as a formal, network-sanctioned social event.
Mm-hmm. The guest of honor, he gleefully announced, would be Queen Liz and her vag.
And the mandate BFO laid down for this event was absolute. Mm-hmm. This is the event of gay days. And you, the listener, absolutely better be there.
It's an assertion of social power. It's an expectation of loyalty. For BFO, the logistics are the measure of commitment.
He required guests to RSVP no later than Monday night, May 12th, either by e-letter or the voicelet line so they could make proper arrangements. This RSVP isn't just a headcount.
It's a loyalty test.
And he added a crucial caveat about the RSVP. Do not reply if you can't attend.
However,
you are more than welcome to call the voicelet line and express how distraught you are that you can't be there. Why is that distinction so important?
It shows that BFO values the emotional response just as highly as the physical presence. If you can't show up, you have to prove your loyalty by expressing your profound disappointment. It's all about commitment to the network narrative, whether you're present or absent.
He was also very transparent about the financial structure. He made it clear this was not a big fatty-funded event.
No. The costs would be between $10 and $25, depending on what you ordered, plus tax and tip.
But he immediately reassured everyone that proper gratuities will be included.
And that detail is important. Amidst all the chaos and boundary pushing, BFO insists on financial decorum and responsibility, its structure applied to generosity.
Following the announcement, he confirms they're busy making arrangements and getting responses. He shouts out Darren, a listener from the old LFC days.
And of course, he urges Darren to join the listener map, always back to the structure.
He also takes a moment to congratulate the occasional F on their second anniversary, May 12th. He's always supportive of the wider network ecosystem.
Provided they are not sources of misinformation.
Fair point. Then we get to one of the week's most memorable listener offers. David the Blue Jeans guy.
Yes. David had made contact before, and now he called in with a voice letter offering his very specific, highly idiosyncratic services.
He offered to be a unique weapon against the network antagonist Taylor the Latte Boy at Gay Days.
His specialized services. My ability to summon crickets and my ability to, well, put people to sleep. He figured this combination would bore Taylor into submission.
It is the perfect BFO verse solution. Deploying mundane, tedious powers as instruments of psychological warfare.
The condition, of course, was that BFO had to cover his room, board, and travel costs.
It's the perfect example of how listeners turn their eccentricities into network currency. David doesn't have money, but he has the ability to summon crickets and induce boredom, and he's offering to monetize those unique talents for BFO's agenda.
The final piece of listener-generated content this week was the RAK t-shirt idea from Miss Kathy.
Right. Since RAK was the theme of the week, she suggested making shirts for female listeners that say, I love my rack.
With RAK standing for Random Act of Kindness?
And BFO's commentary on this was naturally unfiltered and highly specific to the male gaze he often addresses.
He mused that a woman with an especially large rack wearing that shirt would itself constitute a random act of kindness.
Specifically directed at straight men. He even referenced Eric West, a straight listener, to ask for confirmation. He's engaging every niche of his diverse audience with equal measures of absurdity and attention.
And it brings us full circle. From the pure, anonymous generosity BFO admires to the highly conditional, sexualized interpretation of kindness delivered by his own audience.
So we conclude this deep dive with section 5, connecting the philosophical threads of this busy, chaotic, yet rigidly structured week.
Mm-hmm. Let's revisit the BFO lexicon and community lore that emerged.
We added Rebecca, the listener who looks like a turtle. BFO confirmed his dedication to updating his Ruining Your City page on the listener map.
A joke that successfully turns a technical list into a brand statement.
And we heard his apology for nattering on the previous day, his term for his own discursive tendencies, which caused him to miss the Mystery Lane music. That self-awareness, even delivered casually, is part of his charm.
He knows his formula, and he apologizes when he deviates from the necessary structure.
This week also provided a crucial moment for BFO to discuss his philosophy on wealth and charity. He contrasted two distinct economic models, which I think gives a surprisingly rigid moral code beneath all the chaos.
He detailed the story of the listener who paid $100 for strangers' breakfast without asking for recognition. BFO called this magnificent. This is true kindness. The act of giving that requires no transactional reward.
And he contrasted this noble anonymous act with what he called philanthropy with strings,
which he defined as buying recognition for yourself. So for BFO, true kindness is intrinsically selfless, whereas seeking recognition is just an ego transaction masquerading as charity.
It establishes a surprisingly rigid moral foundation. He demands structure in his schedule, and he demands ethical structure in acts of generosity. Why do you think this structural discipline extends beyond his logistics and into his ethics?
I think it's because he sees the lack of structure, the bickering and misinformation he hated on LFC as a waste of time and energy. True morality, like true structure, is efficient.
That's a great point.
Anonymous kindness is efficient. It gets the job done without the drama of ego. And he hates drama that he didn't generate himself.
So if we connect this back to the bigger picture, this week perfectly illustrates the core principle we established at the start.
Mm-hmm. BFO uses consistent life events, the annual visit to George's grave, domestic duties for Mother's Day, scheduled travel, as the structural framework to broadcast his most unfiltered, chaotic, and often drunken opinions.
The reliability of his routine, the annual trips, the specific venues, the required etiquette, that's the foundation that gives him the absolute license to engage in the digital chaos.
The drunken broadcasts, the boundary-pushing jokes, it's structure-enabling ruin.
And that structural discipline is precisely what keeps the audience engaged. You know that even amidst the train wreck, there's always a reliable next step. The next trip, the next required RSVP, the next annual ritual.
Which raises a final provocative thought for you, the listener. Big Fatty built this entire community by openly using the most specific, sometimes embarrassing details of his life.
His struggles with Amazon's targeting, his weight, his travel logistics, it all became content currency.
So what specific, intimate detail of your life, if shared consistently and honestly, could become your own reliable source of community connection? What is your personal dead rabbit search result that could become content?
Something I'm all over until next time.
I'm Gail.
And I'm King. We hope you enjoyed today's look at Ruination, the early years. Join us again next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, the early years.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, the early years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.